Oscars.
Welcome to No Prize from God, episode 14. No Prize from God features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is Miles Kennedy, vocalist for Alter Bridge, Slash featuring Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators, and solo artist. When Miles was just 4 years old, his father passed away from appendicitis, a treatable ailment that went undiagnosed. A devout Christian Scientist, Kennedy's father had refused medical care in accordance with his religious beliefs. Miles is one of many creative people who lost a parent at a young age, a list of artists that includes Paul McCartney, Bono, Madonna, and James Hetfield, whose mother died when he was 16. The Metallica frontman's parents were also Christian Scientists. Miles Kennedy's father died in 1974, the year of the tiger, which is the third year in the 12-year cycle of the Chinese zodiac. The singer, whose soulful voice has drawn favorable comparisons to the late Jeff Buckley, explores themes of love and loss related to his upbringing on his debut solo album, fittingly titled Year of the Tiger. The record is stripped down and intimate, with acoustic arrangements and instrumentation more befitting blues, Americana, or rockabilly than the hard rock of Alter Bridge. Kennedy's voice is rightly admired in hard rock circles. He's actually the guy Mark Wahlberg pulls on stage to replace him in the dorky movie Rockstar. It was on that movie set where he met Jason Bonham, who called him several years later and invited him to audition for a possible album and tour with the surviving members of Led Zeppelin, after Robert Plant refused to continue past a one-off reunion show. Kennedy spent an afternoon jamming with them, followed by another 4 days of rehearsals. Alter Bridge was about to appear at the Download Festival in the UK when Kennedy first got that call from Jason Bonham. Alter Bridge, of course, has released 5 successful albums over the years. Kennedy was one of the singers on Slash's 2010 solo album, which included appearances from Ozzy, Adam Levine of Maroon 5, Alice Cooper, M Shadows from Avenged Sevenfold, Iggy Pop, the late Lemmy, and the late Chris Cornell, among others. Kennedy ended up singing for Slash on the subsequent tour in support of the album, which led to him fronting the band full-time. Slash, featuring Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators, released Apocalyptic Love in 2012 and World on Fire in 2014. Live shows often include a handful of Guns N' Roses classics. So when W. Axl Rose was a no-show to GNR's Rock Hall of Fame induction in 2012, Kennedy stood in for him, performing 3 classic Guns N' Roses songs with Slash, Duff McKagan, Steven Adler, Matt Sorum, and Gilby Clark, 4 years before Axl reunited with Slash and Duff for their massive reunion tour. Miles was my guest for a Q&A session at the Musicians Institute in Hollywood, where we spoke in-depth about his career and he performed 2 songs from Year of the Tiger. Before the Q&A, we sat down for an even more intimate conversation for this podcast, which you're about to hear. We talked about his father's death, his parents' Christian Science beliefs, his own faith journey, and where he is now. Before we get into that, I'd love to share some music from Miles' new album. Up first is the title track, written from his mother's perspective. Stick around after the interview to hear the rockabilly-infused Devil on the Wall. So here's Miles Kennedy with Year of the Tiger, from his debut solo album of the same name.
Got no time for cooling heels, I've got to roll.
no time to waste. A resolution to keep fighting and remain, yeah, on a cold, cruel July.
So here it is, my conversation with Miles Kennedy. This is No Prize from God. Tell me a little bit about, you know, sort of your background in terms of faith and life's bigger questions, mm-hmm. and what some of your first exposure was to those kind of concepts, and, you know, as a kid, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I was raised in a very, it was always there, the idea of a God. And initially, I was brought into this world. Both my mother and biological father were Christian Scientists, and I, from what I understand, their parents were as well, at least their mothers were. You know, that's a pretty, they have a very, at least from what I remember, I don't know if it's evolved, but when it came to getting sick or something, you tried to work that out through prayer, and you had a what was called a practitioner that you would call that help you work through it. And it was a very different way of doing things from what I, I view things now.
And the idea of the practitioner was what they were sort of an intercessory between the believer and God.
Maybe, perhaps.
Kind of, yeah, you know, perhaps. Specifically petition God, hey, fix this
perhaps.
Broken arm or whatever.
Yeah, perhaps. And that's actually a really good question. It's been so long now, I don't want to,
right.
Spread any you know, anything that's not true, but it had something to do with that, or maybe just to help you work through things, almost like a someone to help, maybe to confide in, or
I feel like when I hear the term Christian Scientists, two things come to mind, and it's really the only two things. You're already educating me. One is the Christian Science reading rooms,
yes,
that I see.
Yes.
And the other is yes, this idea of faith healing and healing through prayer, and mm-hmm. to the extent of even discouraging believers from going to hospitals and to seek medical care. I don't really know anything about it beyond those two things. Mm-hmm. I feel like those are the two things that everyone knows.
Yeah. And Mary Baker Eddy was I think she was kind of the genesis of the whole belief system, And I just remember hearing her name a lot growing up. But
so it's a Christian faith, but it's a modern Christian faith.
I believe sort of so. Like I believe it.
Seventh-day Adventists or the Mormon Church. Yeah, or
I believe along those lines. I want to say sometime in the 1800s is when it evolved. But yeah, that was all I knew early on. And then an interesting thing happened. Once, I think my mom's, before Dad passed away, she actually worked at a nursing home. Or like, she was seeing a lot of people in that was involved with that faith that were passing away. And she started to notice that younger people were there as well. It wasn't just elderly people. And she started to kind of put it together that, well, this is interesting. And I've got two young boys. So she discussed with my father that if she got sick, that she did want to seek medical attention. And this all happened not too long before my dad did get sick. And he said, all right, well, if I will respect your wishes. But if I get sick, you respect my wishes, and I want to work it out through prayer. Which is very interesting that within 6 months he then passed away. And she respected his wishes, you know.
And how old were you when he
was four?
Sick? Wow, okay, so very young. My mom passed away when I was 11.
Oh, wow, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and she was born again. My family's Irish Catholic on my dad's side, and then kind of Irish and German Protestant on my mom's side. And she had become kind of a born again through the Presbyterian Church. So I had some experience with that, and she was sick with lupus, and this was in the 80s
when
people knew even, they still don't know much about it, they knew even less about it then, and she didn't die from lupus, but she died from kidney failure and complications that were related to that autoimmune sort of deficiency. But yeah, I bring that up largely because in my life, you know, and friends and so forth, there's a real easy relatability with people that have lost a parent
in early
childhood.
It's a definite club that none of us really wish to be part of.
Right, exactly.
But we all know the void.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that never really goes away. Yeah.
Yeah, and the defining sort of role that it plays in art that you're attracted to, the music you like, the people you gravitate towards, the girls you date or whatever. You know, like it's
true.
It seems like it's always there. Yeah.
It's always there. It's always there.
So, in as much as you know, having a parent, losing a parent to a terminal illness, the role that faith played in that, in particular, with you and being so young, and obviously having, I'm sure, it's already hard enough to grapple with as an adult, but to try to kind of view that through the lens of the religion that your father believed in, what was that experience like?
It was interesting because it didn't. I was so young, and it didn't necessarily shake my faith. I never really questioned God as I was 4 years old. And frankly, as far as I can remember, as far as being a young person, I was always had unshakable faith. And my mom then remarried. An incredible man who's a Methodist minister. So we were no longer part of the Christian Science realm. And we then did deal with things through medical intervention if there was a problem, which I remember that was weird for me because I had been born into something where you didn't do that. And so when I remember I had an absolute terror of doctors initially, just absolutely petrified. I had to get a wart removed on my hand once. And I think that's the first memory I have of actually going to a doctor. And it was as if I was going to the gallows.
Right, you know? Right.
I remember just having severe anxiety because I was raised to believe that you didn't do that. So that was kind of interesting.
I had to feel like going to outer space.
It did
too, because it's the science of it all around you.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah, it did.
People in white coats.
Yeah.
And, you know,
it was so clinical, and it wasn't all warm and fuzzy. You know, that I think that's one of the things about dealing with things through prayer is you just I don't know. I mean, it's hard to even it's hard to even articulate. It's just a different concept. And so, we were then Methodists and, or potluck Protestants, as my friends would, would call me. And that was fine. And I immersed myself in it and tried to understand it all and read the Bible and studied the Bible. And that was my scene for all the way up through my 20s, really.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, I was a card carrying member. And
as that intersected with music, as a teenager, were you into like Christian rock bands?
I was. In fact, when Stryper first came out, that was a big deal for me because then I loved metal and I loved hard rock, but I knew that my parents wasn't really their jam, and then Stryper came out and I got to, that was an easy one to go to that show. My mom marched down and we got the tickets.
Nice intersection.
Yeah. So that was really the only one I remember being into. You know, there were some other bands at that point, but they didn't really.
Yeah. I mean, there was an era where, you know, no disrespect to some, I'm sure, you know, some people listening would be able to point to maybe bands we weren't aware of, but,
sure.
I want to say it wasn't really until the 90s that there were a noticeable amount of legitimate sort of Christian acts that were good bands in their own right versus, well, this is the Christian version of this band. You like the Ramones? Well, listen to these guys. Where you actually had people that were kind of creating art that was on its own terms and just so happened that there was a message in there somewhere that bent. I think people that were into heavy music and hard rock and stuff in the 80s were a bit more starved if they were
absolutely
in the
starved.
Christian scene of trying to, you know, it's like you got Stryper and,
right.
You know, I think Living Sacrifice was around then, but probably not as known. And
there's Blood Good. I remember them.
Yeah.
Because they opened for Stryper.
Yeah.
Petra was the earliest thing I remember, but it wasn't quite heavy enough for me. You know?
Right.
It wasn't, that wasn't going to satiate my need.
Yeah. There was no Tooth and Nail Records in the 80s.
Right.
You know.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a good point. I think Stryper was on Enigma, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. It was I was definitely I was really into it, you know. I was really I tried to walk the straight and narrow but as time went on there were just questions that started to come up. And the logical part of my brain started asking questions that I couldn't get answers for, no matter how intelligent the person was, who was a person of faith, I still wasn't getting, something still wasn't ringing true with me. And suddenly the idea of there being an absolute and the idea of there being this as some sort of deity or an afterlife, I was starting to question, and that was tough. That was really difficult because, you know, that was my whole foundation, you know. And it's such an important part of one's life and how you deal with life, how you deal with anxiety, how you deal with whatever the world or the universe throws your way, you know. So. It kind of sucked.
Sure.
And I have friends who are still very passionate about what they believe, and I kind of envy them, you know, 'cause now that I guess at this point I'm probably more of a, I guess the term is agnostic. Mm-hmm. I fall somewhere in the middle. Actually, you know, that I shouldn't say that because I don't. I'm open, and I know some people have a real issue when people say this, but I almost feel like it takes as much faith to believe there isn't a God.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
If just for me to sit and go, no, there's absolutely
you're
no
open higher. To information.
Exactly.
If your mind could be changed at some point, one way or the other.
Yeah. And
your journey.
Exactly. But I don't see it. I haven't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel like during that time in your life where you had that framework, like you said, it's scary to let go of certainty. Did you ever have any experiences before, during, since that you felt were supernatural or unexplainable, or were you captain? I mean, certainly as a musician, I'm sure there's an argument to be made that you are tapping into something when you're writing and performing and that sort of thing. Do you feel like there's something bigger than us in that sense?
Yeah, I've had moments where music and the power of music, there's something very spiritual and hard to articulate and something very magical.
Yeah. I agree.
But do I feel like that comes from a higher power? I don't know. For me, I found a lot of solace in the idea of now, the idea of being present, and the idea of, that's the thing with music, is when you immerse yourself in it, and whether you're writing or you're, for me, a lot of it's improvisation. A lot of my truly transcendental states have been achieved back in the days when I used to play fusion. Strange,
sure.
with improvisation and that you're definitely staying in the moment, and there would just be things where it's like, wow, you know, this is, you're not worried about what's coming next, you're not paying attention to what just happened, you're locked in the moment, and it's, this is living, this is what it's all about, you know, and
that's so hard to hold on to
harness.
It's so transient.
It's just as hard as, it's why you know, meditating can be so hard.
Sure.
Because it kind of takes practice. Because your brain is constantly, it's always desiring what's coming next, or asking questions, or trying to foresee things, and that can somehow get in the way of really enjoying the moment. You know?
Yeah. As somebody who suffers from obsessive compulsive disorder and anxiety, Anxiety is what, worry about the future and or focus on the past and the scars of the past and whatever, and yeah, that's the hardest part, is to be
horrible.
And that's also kind of the cure for it, you know, is to actually be in the moment.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And there's definitely an argument to be made that a lot of faith traditions have such an emphasis on the afterlife and on a reward and punishment system, you know, that you're aspiring to reach some sort of destination versus the idea that the journey is the destination.
Exactly. It's the idea that, yeah, that there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But I think what kind of planted the seed for me, I should back up a little bit, was when I was about 18, I was watching the Bill Moyer special where he interviewed Joseph Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with Joseph Campbell, but
a little bit.
But he's kind of the, we were joking earlier about the George Lucas room, he played a big part in inspiring George Lucas and many other artists during that period. And he stumbled onto some really cool concepts basically taking so many different myths from so many different cultures and extracting a common truth and a common theme from
the hero's journey. Is that him?
Hero with a thousand faces or whatever.
Okay. Yeah.
But he did it in such a brilliant way. And that was when I was like, wow, this guy is really onto something here. But once again, it scared me because I was like, but what he's saying here with a lot of these myths, or at least what he's, the truth he's extracting is the idea of staying present, and that there may not be an afterlife, or that this, you know, this isn't congruent with what I've been led to believe. So as much as I appreciate what he's saying here, I'm kind of frightened of it. It kind of scares me because it's going to shake my foundation. But it was one of those things that I couldn't stop thinking about. So then I started reading some books and talking to people, and the more time has gone on, I've gradually embraced this more of an Eastern philosophy that has kind of taken me away from the Christian faith, and it's brought me a lot of solace. You know, it's really, because I struggle with anxiety and depression, and it's really been helpful, really, really helpful. Like, recently I've been on a Ram Dass kick. Really, that's been just a real...
We're right in the wheelhouse for this podcast, by the way.
Really?
This is the kind of stuff that comes up a lot and that interests me, yeah.
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 That's good.
I got to, yeah, have Ram Dass on.
Yeah, oh, that would be great.
Yeah, on my wish list.
Oh, yeah, he's just, he just seems so enlightened.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, it's still a journey. I don't have it all sussed out. But all I can say is I feel like I'm doing what works for me. And that's why I try to be careful with, you know, some people are really vocal about being anti-religion or anti-God.
Yeah.
And I try to be careful there because as this...
They want to put you in a category of, you know, I'm this or I'm that or I'm this, even
exactly.
If the category is, you know, this new atheism, as they call it, or whatever, which I think in many ways resembles the fundamentalism and legalism of the worst of religion.
It's true.
You know, and that's not to paint all atheists with that brush, but... this idea right now of that, you know, that religion is the single most cause of all the pain and suffering in the world, and deprogramming everybody from it is this evangelistic zeal. You know, some friends of mine even that have that's their mission is to get everybody into the atheist thing.
Right.
And it's like, well, that feels to me like the Jehovah's Witness at my doorstep.
Yeah, no,
whose mission is to
true.
Save me, you know?
Yeah, you know, you're, that's really, I think you're dead on. I think that. As the song says, whatever gets you through the night, it's all right.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I've really come to believe. Whatever works for you, go with it. But don't be a part of something that hurts somebody else.
Right.
Don't buy into the idea that your faith is the only way. And if people don't subscribe to your faith, then you need to take them out or chastise or whatever it is. That's where I struggle.
Yeah. Or that
that's when it gets dangerous.
Your code that exists within your particular ideology that needs to restrict the liberties of people around you and what, you know, how they're able to live or their
lifestyle.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right.
I found, and this is very recent for me within the last couple of years, I've gotten really into the work of this guy, Peter Rollins, who's a theologian and, you know, has all these PhDs and whatever. He's this Irish guy. He's super funny. But he has this thing that he's developed called pyrotheology, where it's, I mean, he's burning it all down and deconstructing it to try to kind of get to the... I've been really inspired by his work recently because it's really about doubt and the idea that certainty is the real enemy of faith, or these kind of conversations about these concepts, that as soon as people get into this thing of like, okay, I'm this is what I'm into, and this is, you know, I believe these 10 things, and or whatever it is about different religions, different philosophies, that's where a real death happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you get locked into a certain code, and that's not to say, and I struggle with this because there are certain moral truths and certain kind of spiritual truths that I ascribe to, and you know, it's that balance of like, you don't want to just be so like, whatever, man, you know, versus being so rigid and stuck in a certain spot.
Right,
you know?
Right,
so
right, right.
That's kind of where.
What's his name again?
Peter Rollins.
Check it out.
Yeah, I'll send you to some of his, you know, lectures, and he's got a comedic bent to what he does.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I like
that. Really into comedy stuff.
Right, right.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's comedians like Pete Holmes and some of these guys who wrestle with some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of gravitate towards that. And
that's cool.
And yeah, who knows? I don't know if that's losing a parent young that makes us more interested in this stuff.
I think it does.
You confront it earlier.
Sure, yeah.
You
you're
know?
Forced to confront it. You have to.
Yeah.
It makes you, you know, you realize that we all have a, you know, where this is not, at least this, what we have here, our body is not, it's very finite.
Right.
You know?
I almost sort of, with amusement, when I hear people go, you know, and then it's one of those moments where you realize, like, how temporary this all is or whatever, and I'm just like, I feel like I've known that. I feel, you know, I am, like you said, envying people that have a certainty. I envy people that haven't thought about this stuff, because I feel like I've been thinking about
it. Oh gosh,
always.
I know.
It's always there.
You're absolutely right.
But I think that, you know, there's this great quote, something Bono said to Rolling Stone a few years ago, that the best art and music is the art and music that recognizes God or whatever, you know, spirituality is as the pivot, and that it, the best music is either running away from the light or running towards it, and that that's like the art. And I was like, ah, he nailed it.
Good,
like that's
Bono. I mean,
that's the art that I love, right?
Yeah, like, yeah. No, he's definitely he's said some very profound things, and his, he's an interesting read, that's for sure.
Yeah,
his interviews, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and he's somebody that, who I appreciate that he has a moral compass, and doesn't he doesn't let himself be pinned down. You know, the Christians try to claim him, and the atheists might want to claim him. Or, you know, and he's like very much,
he's kind of ambiguous in that sense.
And ambiguity of you know, coming up in that. I mean, being from a war torn place that was divided by sectarianism and religion for so many years. And
that's true. And he lost a parent early on.
Right.
He's another one of I've often thought that somebody should write a book about how many artists have.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
No, I think it's a great idea. I mean, yeah. Because I think it would be interesting. There's so many of the people that I fed off of as an artist, you know, lost a parent at a young age. And Buckley.
James Hetfield.
Christian scientist.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, God That Failed, and some of those songs are like right on the money about that stuff.
Yeah.
I hear faith in your grace. Broken in the promise, betrayal. The healing hand held back by the deepest nail. Follow the God That
Do you, have you met him? Are you guys friendly?
I've never met James.
That was one of the first things that came to mind in knowing about your story, where I was like, that's a conversation.
I heard that, and I was blown away. I was like, wow, he's experienced the same thing.
Yeah.
And I'd be curious what his take.
Black Album, 16 million copies. 16 million people have that song, The God That Failed, and it's literally exactly about that.
Right,
you know?
Right. That's great.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Maybe that's the book we write together.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be really interesting.
Yeah,
because
and like you said, Buckley. And,
I'm kind of drawing a blank, but there's so many. Like,
yeah,
and it's what's interesting is how many times it's an artist that I really, for whatever reason, something they do, something in their art resonates with me
before you even knew that.
Yeah,
exactly.
And I'm like, oh,
yeah,
they're part of the club.
Yeah.
So we just, and I should be careful how I say the part of the club. It's just. Because that sounds odd, but
well, it's not a club you want to join.
No, it's not. I would,
but you find yourself in it. Yeah,
I would look, man. I would give to sit down with my biological father and know who he was, and ask him if he appreciate. You know, if he, was he proud of me? Does he like me? Does he? Mm-hmm. Do you like my music? Do you regret the decisions? I mean, there's so many questions that I can't. I'll never have answered, and just to have an hour, what I would give.
Yeah,
you know. But
do you have kids?
I don't, and frankly, I think part of the reason, for a long time, I was afraid to have kids before I was, because he passed away when he was 34.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was afraid of would I make it to 34.
And this is a very common, I've read about this. This is like a thing. It's not just you. It's those of us in the club. And I had, you know, I have two kids, and very, very similar. You know, my mom was 40 when she passed away, and, I didn't have kids until my mid and late 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very similar, I've read essays about it and, you know, studies, and we have that anxiety, that irrational fear, essentially, that our kids will have the same childhood we had.
Right.
We'll be taken away from them when they're young. And
by
the same turn, I, you know, my kids have a very close relationship with their grandparents on my ex's side. You know, their mom, and they're great, and they're very involved and all that. You know, the fact that my mom was, you know, long gone by the time my kids were born, you know, that she didn't get to know them, and they didn't get to know her, and,
right,
you know,
right.
And then, of course, yeah, when we were so young, I was a little bit older than you were, but still young, you know, 11. The older we get, the further away those few memories become. Right. And it's like, yeah, what you wouldn't give to...
Well, it's interesting hearing how old you were when you lost your mom. I think that would actually be even more difficult because I was 4 and I was still young enough to where I didn't understand what death was. One of the things that my mom told me is that I don't know if I was in denial or I just didn't understand. You know, mom tried to explain that dad was gone, and I said, no, dad's either he's at work and he'll come home. Right. Or the other thing, I just learned this recently, which was kind of heartbreaking. He had just started learning to play guitar, so he had really cheap guitar that he would sit on the bed, and my brother and I would sit there and watch him try to learn the fundamentals. And one of mom's, you know, dad's not coming back, and I was like, yeah, he is. He's got to come back and practice his guitar for David and I. You know, it was a concept that I couldn't grasp as a little person. But when you're 11, I'm sure at that point you have a lot more figured out, and so there's much more gravity to the situation.
And there's a whole thing, and I assume this is common. I know that there's different ways that people handle something like that. I didn't figure this out until later in life, of course, but I handled it by just shutting off. Mm. You know, so I, you know, age 11 to like my early 20s, I thought I wasn't capable of feeling things.
Oh,
you know?
Okay, wow.
And it was, and then, you know, in therapy as an adult and everything, finding out that, I someone explained to me, you have a well of emotions, you just, during a time in life when you're developing the skills to access those emotions, that was robbed from you.
Right.
So the tools that most people have, they developed in that part of adolescence to get in there, you know, and whereas I was, you know, it was just like I flipped a switch,
right,
you know.
Right, right.
And it would obviously come out in, well, oftentimes the wrong ways, anger and whatever, you know, but just really kind of, and yeah, like as a fan of, you know, Metallica and watching like a James Hetfield or something, and then as much as like that's a band, of course, that's opened themselves up to us, the world, to come in and look at their struggles and everything. It's like I see so much. I'm like, whoa, you know, you see so much of like, and And I was I've been a straight edge dude since I was a teenager, so it's like that was my extreme, you know, instead of. Because I know, like, if I was, like, social drinker guy, I'd be the dude with the heroin needle
a few days later, so it was just for me.
It was just, like,
that was
nothing.
Probably wise, yeah.
Yeah, extreme on the other side. Of,
yeah.
You know.
Well, that's good that you recognized that early on. Yeah. So did you have to go through a fair amount of, you know, the therapy and stuff to try and dig?
I wish that I had done more.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I started... in the past few years, even, you know, actually talking to and accepting that idea that like it doesn't make you weak or less macho or, you know, all those things that are put into us.
It's true. There's such a stigma attached to it, but boy, it can be beneficial.
Yeah. There's no stigma attached to eating right or exercising.
Exactly.
You know,
and it's
health.
It's health. You know? And your brain is a machine, and sometimes it needs to be ultimately reprogrammed because what happened is, what happens to anybody who experiences trauma is there are things that just happen to your brain that you have to kind of mend, you know.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't be ashamed for wanting to go. You're not ashamed for taking your car in and having the oil changed.
And the car analogy is so perfect because you know, the very first time I ever sat down with somebody and I said I behave this way and I feel this way and this and that, and it was like bringing your car in and saying my car's making this weird noise. And then to have the person on the other end of the conversation say, oh, well, that's your transmission.
Right.
We're going to get in there and take it apart and rebuild it and this and that. And it was liberating.
It's very liberating.
Because you get so stuck in your own head that you think all of this stuff is specific to you. And for me, it was actually encouraging to learn, like, no, this is very, one plus one equals two.
Exactly.
You know, and the things that, losing a parent can program in you of, you know, abandonment issues and pushing people away because you're afraid they're going to leave and all that stuff that comes in, thinking that that's just you, and then to learn, like, no, this is a thing, and you can just, you know, now that you know, you can deal with it and put it away.
Yeah,
it's liberating.
It's very liberating. It's healthy, and it's And I feel like it just makes you evolve as a person. And I'm really grateful that, you know, I it's been a long time for me, but I went through a period there in my late 20s where I had, it all started to kind of come to a head. That was what was interesting is, you know, I'd been a very, very strong with my faith, and that helped me during that period. But then it was weird. It was like these things just started to happen, like these reactions and these bizarre behavior. And I'm like, where did that come? What is this? And unfortunately, my stepfather was like, son, you know, maybe you should go figure this out. Let's hook you up with someone and talk. And I was like, I thought, is this weakness? Would it, you know, right. I didn't, and normally I would work this out through prayer, but that wasn't working. And so, work it out on stage. But nothing was working, and it was getting weirder and weirder. And so, thank goodness, because it was just like somebody gave me the keys to the castle, you know, and I was like, oh, this is, and then it made me really appreciate the whole study of the, you know, how did they find that out about the brain and how it works and human behavior, and it kind of became exciting for me.
Yeah, and I was always afraid that stuff would take some of the mystery or the magic out of life, and if anything, the more immersed in it I'm becoming, the more it's amplifying that for
absolutely
me.
Absolutely, like, I totally
agree. It's all interesting, and
it's really interesting.
It's magical in that sense.
It is.
Know? Yeah,
it's really magical. It's fascinating. Unfortunately, I married my wife is she's a therapist, a mental health therapist,
nice.
Works with kids. So it's great. And she's always been very careful not to try and analyze me. But once in a while, I'll kind of pray. I'm like, so this is going on. What does this mean? And she's like, okay, well. And she'll kind of just give me a little tidbit.
Yeah.
But she doesn't. Has
That's
never
a great
wanted
approach,
to,
too.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
She's never one to be like, well, this is, you're doing this X, Y, and Z. And this is, she's never preachy. And I've always appreciated that about her. I envy her wisdom in that sense, because she understands what's underneath the hood, you know.
Right.
She understands how to fix the car.
Amen.
Right.
Well, dude, this was awesome. As advertised.
This has been a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Keep up with tour dates, music videos, and general information on Miles at mileskennedy.com. And you can find No Prize From God on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, as well as on Patheos, where our blog takes a deep dive into the subjects we've explored with our guests. You can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downing and on Instagram at SuperheroHQ. And check out past episodes with great guests like Maddie Mullins of Memphis Mayfire, Jesse Leach of Killswitch Engage, Karen Crisis of Gospel of the Witches, Ryan Clark from Demon Hunter, Satir Wongraven of Satyricon, Sister Kate of the Sisters of the Valley, aka the Weed Nuns, Max Cavalera of Soulfly, Modern Tarot author Michelle T, and many more. And please head over to iTunes or wherever you consume podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating and a nice little review. The more of those we receive, the higher the visibility for the podcast and the more it can be discovered. No Prize From God is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. If you're a Metallica fan, check out our sister podcast, Speak and Destroy, a podcast about all things Metallica. Guests have included members of Megadeth, Pantera, Avenged Sevenfold, Machine Head, Lamb of God, and Hailstorm, as well as folks like SiriusXM personality Jose Mangan. So here's that other song from Miles Kennedy I promised, Devil on the Wall. As always, you guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downey.
Devil and God, always creeping in the blind, with shadows of the dearly departed, planting the seed that in time will bloom to be trouble that will rip you apart. Oh, drawn to the light.
seems to me.